Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the elusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So this is the fourth day, final day of this four-day January to 11 retreat here at the Franciscan Center in Tampa. I don't know if I'll have a chance to go through all of them. I just kind of got behind on the notes. So I may not be able to get to all of them, but I do want to share some other things and also talk about post-retreat experience. What's the difference between a yogi and a Buddha? So these are just words. Maybe we could say a yogi is someone who wants to be a Buddha. Therefore, traditionally, yogis are referred to people who practice in retreat environments. And usually they are practicing meditative path to realization. That's a yogi. Be called a hermit, a meditator. Someone who wants to wake. A Buddha is what? You know, there's like capital Buddha, capital B Buddha, referring to Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha. But Buddha really just means someone who's awakened to their true mind, their Buddha mind, the Bodhi mind. And in Zen, it said, we all have the capacity to become Buddhas. So again, and you've heard me say it before, that's why Buddhism is an unusual really actually a highly unusual spiritual tradition. Because in other traditions, one doesn't usually say, you know, whatever, you know, is the highest entity or whatever in that religious system. One usually doesn't say, you know, what's your aspiration? Well, I want to be God, right? Or, you know, I want to be Jesus Christ. Or I want to be Mohammed. Right? I mean, usually that, I don't know what that would be considered. I think people used to get burned for saying things like that. Or at least excommunicated or something of significance. But in Buddhism, you can not only get away with it without, you know, endangering your life, but you're actually, that is exemplary. And that actually is in the Mahayana path, that is the path. Right? One makes the vow, as we heard from Basui today. Right? He makes the vow that he wants to fully awaken so he can be actively engaged in manifesting all the capacities that one has to help relieve the suffering of sentient beings. Can you hear me? Everybody hear me? You can't hear me. What is with this? Or maybe it's what is with me. I guess I should be back. I know David's been trying to give me suggestions. Well, that's the reason I have this, before I can speak in my noble tone of voice and it can be going out. So, you know, so maybe it's just positioning. How is that? Can you hear now? People hear? You can always come closer if you can't hear. I mean, really, I'm, you know, just come closer. But that's better? Okay. Is there anybody turn up the volume? Is that better? Is that better? Is that better? Good. So again, in this Mahayana tradition, in this tradition of the Bodhisattva way, you know, a Bodhisattva is a being who is two things. Anyone on the Bodhisattva path is someone who is actively dedicating all aspects of their life to awakening, and that awakening is always in the service of alleviating, working for the alleviation of the suffering of sentient beings. And that, of course, is an unfolding, right, of development. But anyone who undertakes the vows and the commitment to be a bodhisattva and begins those practices is considered on the bodhisattva path, and in certain circles could be considered, you know, a bodhisattva. But like the bodhisattva of the first degree, if that's the lowest or something, you know, we could say there's all kinds of advancements. But again, when you're on the path, you're on the path. And whether it's the beginning of the path, the middle of the path, the end of the path, you're on the path, because that path is, every path is going in a certain direction. It's going somewhere. So if you have firmly planted your feet on the Bodhisattva path by making the commitment and undertaking the practices, the six paramita, the eightfold path, etc., one is a Bodhisattva in a certain sense. And As understandings, as realizations comes, one is more fully developed in one's capacity to free oneself from one's own self-induced suffering and to be a benefit to others. So there's nothing wrong to want to be a Buddha. Right? I mean, what else is there? I mean, I guess it's, there's nothing wrong with wanting to be a good human being. I mean, I'm not, you know, I mean, there are other aspirations in this life, and to be of help to others, but they're all encompassed in this path for Buddhahood. I have faith, trust in the Dharma and our teacher, but at the present moment I lack trust in my ability, quote unquote, on the my ability to awaken. Will the same practices we are learning lead to trusting myself? You know, sort of a complicated question. It's interesting. The person says, I have faith, trust in the Dharma and our teacher. But I would say to this person, I think you need to look more deeply at that. Because what is the Dharma? What is the Buddha? What is the Dharma? And what is your teacher telling you? That you have the capacity to awake. Isn't that what the Three Jewels teachers are all telling us? You have the capacity to wake. It is not something that is beyond your capacity or ability, because it is right here in your own mind. Right? So obviously, you don't really trust the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha, or your teacher, do you? You're still trusting your own self-identity. And you obviously, this person identifies themselves as incapable, less than, deficient in some way. Oh. Why would I have got the punchline? I can't, it doesn't exist. So for those listening on the recording, I'm just taking a short break to get some batteries for the speaker. What we have been practicing over Vipassana gives us the capacity to do is what? Is clean up our misperceptions about reality. And one of the misperceptions we have, of course, is there's a self. Thoughts are real. They're giving me correct information. Right? Isn't that one of the things we're looking at? You know, so those are the practices that free us from our delusive notions. And one of our biggest delusive notions is our self. And as we are told in this, in the opening verse, you know, remember superiority, you know, free me from superiority complexes, inferiority complexes, and equality complexes. Right? That's what we're talking about. And whether you think you're better than everyone, worse than everyone, or as good as everybody else. That's a story. Nothing but a story you've made up. Or other people have made up and you've believed. But at this point, you have nobody to blame for believing it. But who? Yourself. Because nobody else is inside your mind but yourself. Or your own thoughts. Right? Right? If all of a sudden somebody whispered into your ear, you know, go jump into the river because you're a fish. Would you do it? You'd say no. One, because I'm not a fish. And two, because that's crazy. And three, because, you know, I hurt myself. Right? I mean, you have some capacity to you know, when these voices in your head tell you something about reality, whether it's reality yourself or reality other or somebody, anything else, you have the capacity, if you are practicing and looking deeply, you know, at the nature of thoughts, right, to not react as if you're hearing the truth. You need to look deeper into that. I mean, this Dharma is not like something abstract, something intellectual. It is meant to liberate us. What does that mean? It means to liberate us as we are. In our very incarnation, with all our neuroses, with all our misperceptions, these practices have the capacity of freeing us. But we have to use them. And we have to use them right here. What is this self that I don't trust? And do I really trust the Dharma and our teachers? Especially when the Dharma and the teachers are telling me continually that I can do it. I tell you, don't listen to your teacher. You don't hear what your teacher's saying. You're only listening to your own thoughts. They're more powerful. When you know, this morning we had a wonderful refuge ceremony. Right? What does it mean to take refuge? It means, you know, this is where I go for the truth. This is where I go for support. This is where I go for understanding. This is where I go for guidance. Right? I no longer rely on my own delusion. Right? For countless lifetimes, I've taken refuge in what? I take refuge in my own delusion. Right? I take refuge in my ignorance. I take refuge in my afflictive emotions. Right? That's what we take refuge in. I take refuge in this endlessly bifurcating, flickering mind. It's all over the place. I take refuge in that. Well, no wonder we're in big trouble. Right? So to take refuge really means I take refuge. Even when there's a voice that tells me to go jump in the river and fish, I remember my teacher said, no, you are not a fish. You are a human being. And when that voice tells you to go jump in the river, you don't need to listen to it. It's so simple. That's trust in your teacher rather than your own bifurcating mind. Right? But, refuge is deep. It's more than just a ceremony. It's more than just words. It has to play out in our life. And it plays out just like this. Right? What do I really trust? Do I really trust the Dharma? If I really trust the Dharma, I what? I let go. Right? You know? If I have a guide, if I have a mentor, and I put myself in their hands, and I trust them, right? Then I trust them. You know, unless they tell me to do something totally outrageous, right? You know, like, you know, you're a fish and go jump in the lake, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, short of anything outrageous, go kill somebody. If you're a true disciple of mine, go kill somebody. Or, you know, if you're a true disciple of mine, give me all your money. Or, if you're a disciple of mine, have sex with me. You know what I mean? Unless your teacher does something that's a clear violation. Then if you really trust your mentor, right, then you do what they say. This is how to do it. Right? I have a nephew who's becoming a surgeon. Thank God he's not operating yet. You know, but according to what he tells me, he has good mentors, you know, who are showing him how to do it. Well, it's a little more precise than that, I guess. Right? You know, showing him how to do it, and is watching him very carefully, hopefully in, first couple hundred operations or something, right? You know, and hopefully my nephew, you know, when the teacher says, you know, do this, he's not going, no, I think we should do it like that. You know, because inside myself, I think that would be a better way. Right? Hopefully he's listening to his teacher. Right? So. And again, you know, in the past, we don't jump. Usually to the deepest the most kind of mind-boggling practices. But usually we begin at the beginning, right? We begin with the Four Noble Truths. We begin with mindful living, stabilizing ourselves from the breath, right? Practices that hopefully stabilize us a little bit, quiet us down a little bit, make us less reactive, right? We start practice at that level. So we have an opportunity to gain confidence, right? To gain confidence that the teachings are true, in other words, they work. And we gain confidence when we look at ourselves. We may not be full Buddhas yet, but we may go, I've been practicing for 3 years now, and things are a little better. Right? I am a little less defensive. I am a little less reactive. I am a little more open. I am a little more loving, caring, patient. Right? I'm able to, I still have strong emotions, but they're less intense than they used to be, and they don't last as long, and I'm able to say I'm sorry. I'm even able to see the other's point of view now and then, it's working. I can have confidence in the path and in the teachings. So it's good to reflect this way. Trust, in the meditative tradition, and especially in the path like Zen or the Great Perfections or Pachenmo and the various kinds of meditation paths or imagine Vipassana, in the meditation path, the necessity of the teacher is absolute, having a teacher is absolute, so that issue of having trust in your teacher is probably more acute or more present than if one is just studying Dharma just for stress reduction or a little more peace of mind. A lot of that one can get through books and through DVDs and videos and attending workshops and stuff like that. But if one is, and those of you who have been to private consultations, you know that. As you really begin to uncover the layers, to make sure that you're practicing appropriately the meditative practices, applying them correctly, and having some support, guidance, counsel in terms of how to deal with stuff as it comes up is essential. Also, to make sure that the things we think we understand, we really understand, and is correct. So it is important to have a relationship with the teacher in this path. What relationship is there between these questions and the inquiry process that you described? Is it true? What evidence do I have that it's true? What does it matter if it's true? Is this semantics? Is this what's your name? Those questions? Yeah, the Byron Katie. Yeah, that's all. It's all good stuff. Actually, Thich Nhat Hanh, actually, the is it true comes from cognitive therapy, where you test your, you test your thoughts. There the analogy is, rather than treating each of my thoughts and my core beliefs and perceptions as theorems, like truth, I treat them as hypotheses. Yeah. So, that's certainly a good way to do it. That's what Michelle? That's what Michelle was sharing with us yesterday, right? Her mind threw up certain perceptions about what was going on, and the truth was she found out by just seeing how things turned out that they weren't true, right? That they were false perceptions. But, questioning in this way, is it true, immediately when it happens, saves you the trouble of having to wait for the results. Because a lot of times, if you see Fred carrying four apples, first of all, you don't have to think anything. I would recommend that first. you know, it's just another phenomenon, you know. But we have to comment on everything, don't we? I mean, we can't just let anybody walk by with four apples without making up a story about it. Right? So I certainly recommend letting people carry apples about without us having to, and I would say that about pretty much everything. Just let the world be. Stop ascribing meaning where there's no meaning. Stop labeling and perceiving when there's no need. Things are wonderful just as they are. Let it unfold. It's unfolding moment to moment. We keep stopping it with our stories, okay? So, is it true is a good way, you know, if you practice something like that, is a good way to go. That's right. He's giving us up an apple edition, right? You know what I mean? And all of a sudden, you're getting very concerned about him, and you start talking to people after it. I think our teacher may have an addiction that he's not in touch with. Maybe it's time to do an intervention. Right? You know, that's one path to go. Right? You know, there are lots of different paths. Right? Maybe the fruitarian, there might be another path to go. Maybe he's a hoarder. And we could go on. I mean, there'd be endless stories. But the truth, Michelle, is that you found out is one, you had no idea, did you? And most of the times we have not. All these things we inscribe and impute about reality and things, we have no idea. And we think if we create a story about something, we know something. All we know is our own story. Our stories about reality are not reality. Our thoughts about life are not life. This is essential. So give it up. You know, you want to know a human being? Look at them. Right? Talk to them. Let them reveal themselves as they are. You don't have to put them in a conceptual box with lots of words and thoughts and emotions. You know, we box reality in. And we think it's real. But it's our own box that we've created. And then we live from that box. Right? Like David was saying yesterday, you know, all his expectations is what? Right? Just get him, you know, if you expect the bell, if you're already thinking about or imagining or remembering how the bell sounds, it contaminates the experience. Right? If you have any thought, you know, if you have any thoughts about, you know, what's going to happen after retreat, you're contaminating, could be contaminating the unfolding of your life. Right? And you can have expectations. And you have expectations of what? They can either be fulfilled or not. If they're fulfilled, right? Let's say our expectation is, I'm going to come home and everybody's going to see that I'm transformed. It's just going to be a glow that's going to radiate. Right? You walk in the door, honey, I'm home. No response. TV still on. You know. Hi, how was Richard? You know, you're like, you'll be what? Crushed. Don't they see my inner radiance? All the hard, but you know what I'm saying? We're just setting ourselves up because we have what? Expectation. What's an expectation? A thought. What's a thought? I don't know. But whatever I do know, they're not real. They have no permanence. They have no stability. They have no nature of anything that's any substance. I know that. I don't have to listen to them. I don't have to heed them. I don't have to run my life on them. Right? So again, is it true? Right. You know, whoever asked the question, good question, ask it deeply. Ask it about your perceptions, your thoughts. You know, is it true that I have a self? Right? Meditative practitioners were asking this question 2,500 years ago. Is it true I have a self? Is it true that I have a past? Is it true that I have a future? Is it true? I'm going to be alive tomorrow. So can I really say that? I'm totally healthy. Free of disease. Is that true? We're all going to meet again. Is that true? None of it's true. We don't know. Right? And that's okay. Because reality, just as it is fine. This is fine. Is anybody missing anything now? I mean, you're sitting here, just sitting here, in this moment. Is there anything missing? I mean, would you like music in the background? Certain smells, aromatherapy, would you like? Would that make this a better moment? Do you see what I'm saying? We can... What's wrong with this as it is? What else do you need? What else do we need? So where somebody says, let go, and then let go. Some people just share their kind of insights or thoughts. Can one think non-dual thoughts? What does it say in the verses on the faith mind? Immediately say not to. Not to is non-duality. Right? So we're saying non-duality, a dual or a non-dual thought. A thought is just a thought. Right? Duality means we split reality into two things. A ceiling can only exist in relationship to what? A floor. If there was no floor, no ground, there couldn't be such a thing as a ceiling, could there? Right? Up only exists in relationship to down, man only exists in relation to woman, right? So, if thoughts are held and believed, they can split reality. But in and of themselves, they are what they are. But if we begin this process of labeling and splitting up, right, me, you, that's a thought. Somebody said the other day, birth, death. These are just thoughts, labels, to experience that never ends, just unfolds. We say someone is born, right? When they what? When they appear out of their mother's. We say they're born. But the truth is they've been alive for what? At least 9 months, right? And before they were born, they were what? Eggs and chromosomes. And their mommy and daddy's body. And where did those eggs and chromosomes come from? And on and on and on. And I can go the same way. Things are just unfolding, empty of anything, changing, impermanent, transforming energy, right? And yet we look and we go, oh, I didn't see it before this moment. I'll call that birth. Birth means what? Something has appeared. Nothing appears out of nowhere. Death means it disappeared. They've left their body, we say. Right? So, we dispose of their body, don't we? Right? We loved them, we treated them, we liked them, we didn't like them, right? And once they're dead, what do? We dispose of them. Just like that, right? Right? For years and years, we had all these things in relationship with them, thought about them, cared for them, didn't care for them, worried about them, hated them, right? Blamed everything on them, right? And all of a sudden, what? They're dead. We dispose of them. On to the next. But something has happened. Something has left that body. What is that? A few things from the Sui and then from Empty Cloud, and then we'll that Basui wrote to the layman Ippo, I-P-P-O. Everyone is perfectly endowed with this Buddha nature. Its substance is the same in ordinary beings as it is in Buddha, with not the slightest difference in degree. So Buddha and sentient beings are what? Us. We all have the same nature. It is not different. Right? The only difference is that a Buddha knows that, and we have forgotten that. Its substance is the same in ordinary human beings as in Buddha, with not the slightest difference in degree. But because men and women cannot bring themselves to believe this, they bind themselves to delusion with the rope of unreality by saying, see, they must have known that question. By saying, the realization of my self-nature is beyond me. So this is 14th century Japan. People were sending notes to their teachers about, I can't do this. It's beyond me. It is better that I recite sutras, bow down before Buddhas, and enter the way gradually through the grace of all Buddhas. Now, that sounds like what? Traditional kind of religious practice. The path of awakening, the path of meditation, is too much for poor little me. Just better, be a humble person. Be a nice person. Spend maybe 15 minutes in the morning reading sutras, lighting some candles before the Buddha. Right. And then very slowly, maybe after 100 lifetimes, 500 lifetimes, right? Maybe at that point, something, I'll have the capacity. So the realization of my self-nature is beyond me. It is better that I recite sutras, bow down before Buddhas, and enter the way gradually through the grace of all Buddhas. right? So that's also saying, you know, I need the grace of something higher than me. I can't do this by myself. Most of those who hear this accept it as true. And again, if you, did a poll of most lay Buddhists in the world, this is probably what they would say.
Actually.
And obviously they were saying it 700 years ago, too. But this is then. So most of those who hear this accept that it's true. It is though one blind man were leading many blind men in the wrong direction. These people do not really... We're having the same conversation. These people do not really believe sutras and Buddhism. On the contrary, they set no store in them. For if they truly accepted them, they would know that merely reciting the sutras is no more than looking at them from the outside. And speaking of Buddha, but a Buddha, quote, quote, around Buddha, but another way of speaking of the essence of mind. A sutra says, mind, Buddha, and sentient beings, these are not to be discriminated one from another. Accordingly, a man or woman who does not believe in the reality of their own mind, but says they believe in Buddha, is like one who puts their trust in a symbol while spurning the real thing. He's talking about what? Modern day religion. It's all about symbols and concepts. To put the faith in Buddha means you put your faith in your own awakened mind. There is no Buddha outside of that. Please understand. We call this piece of wood Bodhidharma. But this is not Bodhidharma. Is a symbol of Bodhidharma. Who is Bodhidharma? It's your own earnest desire to wake up. It's your own fearlessness. It's your own capacity to be unwilling to accept anything but all the full potential you know within you. That's Bodhidharma. Please understand, when you're bowing to Bodhidharma or invoking Bodhidharma, that's what you should be invoking. Right? That's what he's here to remind us of. You know, that's not Shakyamuni Buddha. That's a symbol. That's a representation, just like a thought. It's not the real thing. It reminds us of a man who awoke to his true nature. It reminds us of a man who looked deeply into reality, who was bothered by impermanence of everything that he believed in, right? Who wanted to know, is there more to existence, you know, than just indulging a sensual life and accumulating possessions? A man who was willing to go in another direction, right, than his world and society. That's, you know, and more and more. You know, that's, so please, in your invoking of the Buddha's names and the Bodhisattva's names, in your reading of the sutras, in your any kind of ritual devotion you do, don't just do it on the surface. These things have deep meaning. But we need to be willing to go into the meaning. Now again, I forgive me if I've been referring to this as Bodhidharma for the last 4 days. If I hope I haven't confused anybody. is a symbol. Bodhidharma is no longer present to us in the flesh, right? So we carve things like this in a certain way to remind us, right, of his awakening, of the power of his teachings. So if we just bow down to him like a piece of wood called Bodhidharma, nothing's happening. Nothing's going to happen. Right? I mean, we could just, you know, the wood sculptor didn't have to do this, good, right? He could have just kept it, that one nice piece of wood and wrote on it Bodhidharma. Right? And we could be just bowing down to that. I mean, that's all. Oh. It would have the same effect. In this practice, we want to, you know. Oh, he does talk about finger pointing to the moon. Finger pointing to the moon. These are all fingers. We want to see the moon. Don't just look at the finger. All these symbols, all these words are pointing toward truth, toward your true mind. Right? Please remember that. Can you see what I'm saying? I mean, if I just put a piece of wood up here and said Bodhidharma, and just hung up a plain piece of paper up there and put Shakyamuni Buddha, you'd feel gypped. Right? Oh, Fred's just trying to save money. Wonderful that Buddha. You know, in the early days after the Buddha, there was no symbolism. You know that. It was hundreds of years after. You know, when he was still a living presence and the living presence of memory, when people were still alive who had practiced with the Buddha or their teachers had practiced with the Buddha, you know, there was enough living energy of the Buddha alive that no symbol was made. But over time, people wanted a representative. You know, in the early days, they just would, you can still see them in India, just footprints. Right? Things like that, or a lotus, or, you know, there'd be like symbols like that, or the Dharma wheel was one of those. You know, there was no physical representation of the Buddha. That didn't come actually to Buddhism, you know, got to Afghanistan and everything, and it meant the Greeks, you know, and the Greeks, as you know, very adept at forms, you know, their gods and everything. And it was really then that all of a sudden the first, you know, forms of the Buddha. And if you go to museums and you see those Dandara Buddhas, what do you notice about them? They don't look like these Buddhas. They have mustaches. They have flowing hair. They look like what? Greeks or Afghanis. You know, that's what they look like. I mean, you know, people made the representations in their own, you know. So don't think like the Buddha looked this way. You know, people make, you know, you see Buddhas made in China, you see Buddhas made in India, you see Buddhas made in Korea. They kind of look like the people of those cultures, right? Because that's the way they represent it. The sutra says, mind, Buddha, and sentient beings, these are not to be discriminated from one another. Accordingly, a man or woman who does not believe in the reality of their own mind, Buddha mind, but says they believe in Buddha is like one who puts their trust in a symbol while spurning the real thing. How can then he or she realize this true mind? One who only wants to recite sutras is like a hungry person who refuses food offered in the belief that they can allay their hunger by merely looking at the menu. Is that clear? Look what he's saying, Master Vasuri. He said, if we think reading the sutras and reciting the sutras is going to nourish our transformation and healing, it's like a hungry person going to the restaurant and just looking at and reading the menu. Right? You may study the menu. You could memorize the menu. Right? You could be able to recite every word of that nendo, everything in it. You might even get some other books where you actually study all the ingredients in it, right? And you know what every ingredient is, and you can describe them endlessly. There's maybe a certain kind of cooking style that that restaurant does, and you become an expert on that. You read all the books on French cooking or Vietnamese cooking, right? But you miss one important thing. Why did you come to that restaurant? Because you were hungry. Hunger is what? It's real, right? If you're really hungry, you know, reading a menu will not satisfy your hunger, right? If reading a menu satisfies your hunger, I would say, I don't think you're really hungry, right? You aren't really hungry. Because just reading a menu and leaving satisfies you, right? If you're here, if you're practicing this way because you are hungry for transformation, if you're hungry to be free of self-centered living, if you're free of having, you know, a heart that's still wounded, if you're sick of having walls separating you, right? Then you want spiritual nourishment that'll help transform you, heal you, right? Right? I mean, that's what you want. Again, is there anything wrong when you get to a restaurant and reading the menu? No. It kind of tells you what's being offered. But then please order some food from the waiter and then eat it. Each sutra is but a catalog of mind nature. One of the sutras says, the teachings of the sutras are like a finger pointing to the moon. Very faint. This is like one of those things in Zen that they'll just ram down your throat. Right? Words. Right? Images. All the wonderful teachings of the Buddhas and Masters, they're all pointing toward our true mind. Right? That's what they're all doing. And all the qualities of reading about them, reading about compassion, does not make you a compassionate person. Right? Doing loving-kindness meditation does not make you a loving-kind person. Right? Reading the Heart Sutra does not mean you have, prajna wisdom functioning within you. You can only access that when you totally access your true mind. Your true mind that is not divided up, that is not imprisoned by a self, right? It's like there's this great light, and then there's a little, what's it called, prism, you know? And like that prism is kind of catching the light and just turning it into its own little divisions, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like that. You know, get it out of the way. So all the light of your true nature can come through. Why do you think masters are wise? It's because they have accessed their true nature, and one of the capacities of their true nature is to know the nature of reality. You know, there was that, you know, the sixth patriarch of Zen, right? Wei Meng. You know that story, I've taught that in the past. I won't go into it, but he's quite well known because why? Because he was illiterate. He was a charcoal seller in the market. And one day there was a monk coming through the market, and if you ever been to Asia or Buddhist countries, you know, a lot of time itinerant monks or hermits will go around and they'll recite Buddhist teachings in places or put people's homes, and people will give them little donations. So there was a monk reciting the Diamond Sutra. And all of a sudden, a certain phrase was chanted, and immediately Wei Nang had an enlightenment. He understood his own nature. never understood anything about Buddhism, never studied a word about Buddhism, right? And you know the story is what? He's so transformed in that moment, he goes to the monk and starts asking questions about the sutra, and the monk says, look, you know, I come from such and such monastery. If you have questions about the sutra, go see the master there. So he gets his mom all set up, and he goes to the monastery, where he's treated like dirt. He's an illiterate, charcoal seller. He's not a monk. He has no money. He has no class, you know. The fifth patriarch is ready to pass on his patriarchy. He's getting old. I don't forget, he was dying, but anyway, he was old. And he asked everybody to write a poem showing the depth of their enlightenment. Right? Wenyuan couldn't write. He was actually he showed up in the monastery because he was the lowest on the totem pole. They had him out working in the kitchen, pounding rice and washing pots for a year. He wasn't even allowed in the meditation hall or in the Buddha hall or anything. He'd been working in the kitchen. And he hears about all this hubbub about, fifth patriarch is dying, and they've been asked to write poems of enlightenment, and then, the teacher will decide based on this poem of understanding. And, it's a long story. But anyhow, what basically happens is, he can't read, so he asks somebody to take him to where the head monk has written his poem, everyone who thought was going to get it. And he says, please, recite the poem to me, and recites the poem. And then he has the audacity to say to this person, I have a poem. Would you write it on the board for me? I couldn't believe it. This illiterate barbarian, dares to think. But he did it. And anyhow, he dictates something which is much more profound. And eventually he got the bowl and the robe. And he became the sixth patriarch. And he was illiterate. What? I sort of know them, but it's next retreat. actually, I did a whole retreat on the platform sutra once. But I want to, we only have limited time. Well, we have very limited time. I'm just saying, he's illiterate. Right? And he became the sixth patriarch. That is the wonderfulness of Zen. Right? It's based on realization. Doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, rich, poor, you can recite all the sutras from memory, you can't, you have intellectual. Wei Ning had intuitive understanding. The teachings of the sutras are like a finger pointing in the room. Please remember that. All the teaching, all words are fingers pointing at the moon, meaning they're pointing at experience. Right? Do not mistake the finger for the moon. Look deeply. Can the Buddhas have intended that you acknowledge the finger and not perceive the moon? Everybody contains within themselves the substance of all the sutras. If you catch even a glimpse of your true nature, your self nature, your Buddha nature, what is your Buddha nature? That right now which is listening to this talk, that right now which is looking at me, this is your true nature functioning. When you call it a self, when you think it's yourself, when you call it a whatever you want to call it, you are limiting and misperceiving what is true. If you catch even a glimpse of your self-nature, the same as reading and understanding all the sutras simultaneously, none accepted. And without so much as holding one in your hand and reading a word. So for those of you who don't like to read, right? And though you say, I read this stuff, but I just can't remember it. This should give you solace. You can understand all the sutras simultaneously, none accepted without so much as holding one in your hand and reading a word. And then Basuri says, isn't this real sutra reading? And then he says, look, that green bamboo grove over yonder is precisely your own mind. And this mass of flowers before you is nothing less than the supreme wisdom of the universe. Do not look for the truth outside of your own experience. It is right here. When the doors of perception are cleansed, we see clearly. So that's Father Basui, great ancestor. So I wanted to give you a little flavor of Zen. But again, I mean, this is, and again, it's always different with the cultures or whatever. Zen, you know, was in China, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, right? And took the flavors of the culture, but yet at heart the same. Within the Theravada tradition, within the Vajrayana tradition, the Vajrayana meaning of Tibet and the areas around Tibet, Theravada medium in most of the Southeast Asian countries, we also will find the same authentic resonance among realized masters. And if you encounter a realized master in the Hindu tradition, or in the Christian tradition, or in the Muslim tradition, Jewish tradition, they will speak the same way. Symbols may be a little different, the semantics may be different, but there's only one mind. Don't be confused. But there's only one earth. And even though somebody may plant something over here, and somebody else may plant something over there, and somebody may call it this over here and that over there, right? It's one earth. No matter what language you call that out there, right? That doesn't change, no matter what you call it, right? No matter what you think about it. And you can call it endless different names, and you can think about it endless different ways. It's still that. So I want to spend a few minutes, and then we should end. We have time for our final circle, talking about the post-retreat practice. Right? So we have been here, in a fairly rarefied environment for 4 days, where all the conditions have been right to nurture our introspection. Right? We haven't had to do anything. We were provided lodging, we were provided hot water, we were provided delicious food 3 times a day, we were provided a place to meditate, we were provided a schedule, we were provided silence, we were provided heat, you might. So ideal conditions. And we had silence. So ideal conditions for practice. I don't think any of us live in a retreat center or practice center. Right? So we will be returning to what we arbitrarily call the real world. Right? And everybody, and when I say the real world, has their own picture of what their real world is. But there's probably a lot more going on than here. And the conditions are different where here all the conditions are meant to nurture. Right? Peace of mind, openness, trust, right? Deep looking, sharing. In a certain sense, our environments are often not nurturing of those types of seeds. And if anything, there are many active forces that are trying to nurture other types of seeds within us, right? It's called the world. Let me say a couple of things. First of all, you, I don't know how you feel, but you've been sitting and practicing this dharma for 4 days, and there's a certain kind of energy that has come to you. Right? Whether your practice has been wondrous or whether your practice has been terrible, it doesn't matter. When you sit and practice this way for 4 days, there's a certain kind of state of mind and a certain kind of energy that is available to you. If you leave retreat and immediately just get totally involved in activity, talking, conversation, doing this, doing that, you will see within a day or two it will all just be depleted. Right? And you'll wonder what happened to it. Okay. Retreat will become a memory. And whatever insights or understandings you had will be memories. I mean, they'll be memories anyhow, but they won't be living. So, take your re-entry, if you can control it, slow. Right? Don't be turning on the TVs right away, and don't be turning on the car radios right away. And, you know, and if people ask you, you know, about retreat, you might just tell them a little bit. But you don't have to, you know, talk for hours and tell everything. I mean, not that it's anything secret, but you haven't been talking for 4 days. Right? Unfortunately, I've been the one who's been talking for 4 days. So I need to go on retreat now. But you have not been talking for 4 days. So again, talking can become very intoxicating too. And again, it's a way to dissipate energy. You may be tired because you've made a lot of effort in these days. Just sitting for 4 days and working with the mind the way we did for 4 days. You may be tired, so please try to get the rest, you know. And also, you've been meditating 6, 8, 10 hours a day for 4 days. So please try to continue to do as much meditation as you can over these next days. Again, most of you, I think all of you, are part of our community, part of Sanghas. Please make use of your communities to sit with them, to meditate with them, to continue to engage in Dharma talks and discussions, because all these kind of Dharma activities nurture these seeds of practice that are so important. The practices that we have done here, these insight practices, some of you have been able to wield that sword of Manjushri to one degree or another and have gotten some insights and understandings about matters of great importance. Other people have at least become familiar and know that now these practices exist. And they hopefully know how to use them or have a little insight into reality, a little bit of clarity about impermanence, suffering, non-self, and how everything is just made up of parts. Nothing is self-existent. And a little insight into thoughts and what thoughts are and what they're not. But these insights that you have run counter to the way the world sees it. So you have to, it's up to you to keep it alive. And the best way to keep it alive is to keep the practice going. I was going to say, one of the reasons we have an intensive that I think you're all aware of, that's beginning in a couple of weeks, on insight practice. And the reason I chose this retreat and the intention to start soon afterwards was to link the two. Because obviously, as everybody has realized, you know, full realization of these practices, you know, do not come in 4 days. These are practices one does for a significant amount of time to get the results. So, for those of you who are in the intensive, there will be opportunity over these next 4 months to be very directly involved and supported in inside practice. I was going to say, well, I will say that if there are people here who did not sign up for the intensive but want to sign up for the intensive, I think we can open registration maybe for a day, because I need to kind of let people know what we're doing. So if Angie could open it on the website for maybe a day. So if there is anybody who didn't sign up or wants to sign up, please do. Yes.
We're leaving.
Leaving what?
Before.
Leaving your body. Where are you leaving to?
Like Canada? I'm leaving Canada.
Yeah, well, most of the... there are people who... in the intensives who do not live close by and maintain phone contact. And yeah, so that's... and there's actually... usually a phone sangha of people who do not live close to a sangha who meet bi-weekly on the phone for support and discussion. So that's right, and that's exactly why we have the phone sangha for people who aren't right here. And let me just also say, you know, the Florida Community Mindfulness, this teacher right here, you know, this is not the end all and be all. We are a community, we do practice together, we do, you know, there is nothing wrong if you see an insight, you know, and again, Mahayana is a little different than in the Theravada way. If you went through what's called Vipassana, which is a very, you know, common practice today, a lot of Vipassana insight practices, it is different than what you see here in the Mahayana. But it's all good stuff, right? So, and the one thing about these insight centers in the Zen tradition, they have sesshins that last a week. In the Tibetan tradition, you'll often see retreats and everything around the Vipassana or Hatong insight practices. You know, if you're a good teacher and a good community, take advantage of it. I mean, we only do it. A certain amount of retreats. The only really long one we do is a 7-day up in North Carolina. You know, wonderful to do a 7-day or a 10-day or a 30-day retreat if you have the time. But also, actually, starting in a few weeks, you know, we have our Empty Cloud Cottage, which is for members to do solitary retreats with daily interviews with a teacher. And we actually... have in February and beginning of March 7 people signed up, several for 7 days, 6 days, and the others for 3 and 4 days. So that'll be also an addition in our community for people who want to focus on these practices. So I guess what I'm saying there is, if you have the time, there is a lot available. And again, different teachers and different insight traditions we'll do it differently, but it doesn't matter. It's all good and it's all helpful. And the more you understand about the nature of your mind, the nature of your experience, you will be understanding more deeply the reality of your own nature. So that's good. Questions before we end this. Yes.
When you put on the website the times available in April.
Yes, I'll actually put them right on. Yeah. See, I was hoping that we could get some software that would so everybody can make their reservations, but people doing that are still working on it. So I will write for April and May. I'll put it up. Send me an email to remind me. Thank you. Any other questions before we end? So, me just step out one direction. I want to have a short break. Just about 200 by the bathroom. We'll take a little stretch. We're now going to have our closing circle. And our closing circle will be a variation on what we've been doing. So instead of the past 24 hours, we now have 4 days. So again, very interesting.
But I really invite you the next few minutes to just do a little exercise in yourself. This is important. It's very important if one wants to take something forward into one's life, to identify what that is, to set the intention, and actually to spend a moment actually visualizing or imagining how one's going to implement it. So if there's anything, any practices, or any insight that you have into your life, or how you want to develop yourself, or how you want to interact with, deal with a certain situation that maybe has come to you, or just any aspect of teaching or practice and insight that you want to keep alive when you leave here, what I would say is, reflect on that now, right? And actually take a moment to imagine yourself bringing it into your life. And you might even spend a moment imagining if there are any kind of obstacles and how you would take care of that. So in the closing circle, there will be an opportunity to share those nuggets of experience from these 4 days. And also, if there's any, a lot of times people want to say something about the retreat or the people in the retreat, this will all be a time for you to share what's in your heart. And so why don't we just before we break, just take a moment, everybody, just do your own review. And again, any nuggets, personal nuggets, of insight or understanding that you want to take into your daily life. We often say, yeah, I want to remember this so I can do things differently in my life. Or any changes that being on retreat and what's come to you in retreat, pointing to your daily life, your daily schedule, how you conduct, how you spend your time, your energy, your interest, how you relate to those in your life, and how you deal with yourself and your own living situation. So please take a moment to kind of take that kind of inventory and reflect and imagine how you're going to take that into your life. And then see how it's going to unfold. I realize it's just an imaginary thing, but it also points us more concretely in the direction we want to go.